Right, welcome. Most of us are probably familiar with Mozilla or derivative of it, so we probably use it. Today we have Manish Singh with us, and he's been working at Flock for a year doing browser development. Prior to that, he was at Oracle on the Linux projects team. He's also been involved with GIMP and GTK Plus for nearly 10 years. He's the author of GIMP Tool. He has contributed to the LDP. He's given talks at a handful of LUG meetings and wrote and presented a tutorial on how to use various user space debugging tools, things like GDBS, TASE, Valgrind, etc. And he gave those to external developers involved in the Oracle technologies at multiple locations, lots of different locations. He's also attended last year's LCA, so I don't know that he's actually given a a tutorial as yet in the LCA, have you, Manish? Today, I'm looking forward to it, and I hope everybody else is, a tutorial on writing plugins for extensions.
There's a difference.
Writing extensions for Mozilla. Welcome, Manish Singh.
All right. So, how many of you have actually tried writing extensions before? How many of you have worked with JavaScript and then web pages and all that? So most of you. All right, cool. So to start off, we're going to walk through writing a very simple extension, and then I'll go on to some advanced topics. There's code, and if you guys want to follow along, download that. I will be going through it on screen, but if you prefer on your laptop, you get the option. An extension is, well, there's a plugin, which is a ABI, and a binary interface, which has not been changed for, like, the early days of Netscape. And they're written, so they're compiled for, like, Flash as a plugin. Extensions can be written, are Mozilla specific and can be written in a number of languages. Also, the plugin interface is not limited to Mozilla, whereas the extension stuff is. Everyone gotten if they wanted to? Alrighty. So, I'll give a brief overview of the Mozilla platform. It is open source. It is one of, perhaps the most popular open source project out there. Because it runs on Windows and the whole people don't want to use IE thing. The most famous being, of course, Firefox, but it's not limited to Firefox. I work on a derivative of Firefox called Flock, which we build on top of Firefox to kind of integrate with some of the newer web properties out there, and we try to target the kind of social networking and people who blog and people who like to share photos. And then we have Thunderbird, which is a mail client, but still built on top of the Mozilla platform. And there's something called Songbird, which is kind of like iTunes, again, on top of the Mozilla platform. And then the Mozilla guys have made this Zool Runner thing, which allows people to develop their own applications on top of the Mozilla platform, so it's kind of open-ended. And while not directly related to extensions, the stuff I'll be talking about will be applicable to writing your own Zool Runner project if you want to. And the other thing about Mozilla is that it's cross-platform. It runs on Windows, it runs on OS 10, and it runs on Linux, it runs on other Unixes. And so you're right that we can, and the greatest one thing about, I work on Linux, I develop on Linux. Even though 90% of my user base, what I do at work, is on Windows. It doesn't matter. I can develop a Linux where I'm happy. So that's cool. So I'll be mainly talking about JavaScript, like writing the extensions in JavaScript, since that's an integral part of the platform. Large portions of the browser are written in it. A good chunk of the UI code. All the stuff around the rendering region is written in JavaScript. And it gets kind of a bad rap because it doesn't actually suck. But most people are exposed to it through the web development thing, and it sucks there because you have to care about other browsers like IE or Opera or Safari and all that. And then all their JavaScript implementations are slightly different. And their DOM, the way to handle the DOM is slightly different. And you got to care for all of that. So that's like 90% of your work, figuring out how to coerce IE to do what you want. And so the advantage, it's not a problem when you're targeting a Mozilla-based browser because there's one JavaScript implementation and you can use all the fancy features. And you don't have to care about if it works in IE because it's not going to work in IE. It's a Mozilla extension. And plus, since JavaScript, the Mozilla people keep on adding to it, enhancing it, new features like the generators and iterators and list comprehensions and all that. And you can use all that, even though some other browsers don't support it. You can use it and to help write your code better. There's also the other part of writing Mozilla extension is to use XUL. XUL is pronounced XUL, which is the XML user interface language. It is a cross-platform UI abstraction. So it abstracts out that on Linux it uses GTK, on Windows it uses a native Windows UI widgets and all that. And on OS X, it uses the OS X directly. But you don't have to care about that because there is an abstraction, XUL, which sits on top of that. So, yes, you can develop on one platform, and it'll work on the others for the most part. And most of the browser UI is actually written using XUL, so it's not something that's just an add-on to it. It is an integral part of the entire platform. So we'll start with a little simple extension. I know I went through that quick. It's easier to show than to tell, so. Can everyone read that? Looks a little small. What do you do font? There it is. That looks horrible. Okay. Everyone should be able to read that. So XUL is XML. Starts with your normal XML preamble. And the way you make XUL look pretty, like define font sizes, colors, and things like that, spacing, is via CSS, just like you do a web page. So here we tell the browser to use the default UI styling, so it looks like the rest of the browser. We're going to make a simple dialog here. And then I've added a custom one, which I'll get to later. The other part, so important for localization. Is instead of hard coding English strings in your extension, you define XML entities, which alias to actual strings. And we'll use that like here, where we define a label. This is so that you define it in a separate file. This way it can be, depending on what user's locale, whether it's English or Spanish or French or whatever, that is referred indirectly, so it can be substituted depending on the user's locale. Then we define a window. The window directive. Oh, I should have said, if there's any questions, feel free to interrupt me. I don't want to wait for questions until the end. So, and then this is important. You'd find the XML namespace to be for Zool. This is a Zool document. And the rest is pretty straightforward. We say the title gets an XML entity, so we're not putting the actual text there, but we're saying the title is defined to be that entity. We give it a width of 200 pixels, height of 100 pixels, and then we say when the window is loaded, we want to run that bit of code there, the function. Or that function defined is in this file, which is not in the Zool file, it's in the JavaScript file. I'll get to that in a sec. And then we just say, here's a box. The box is you put UI elements in the vertical box so they get stacked vertically. The alignment of the internal, the children of it is just centered. Then we just have a label. Again, it's an XML entity and not a real string. And then we have another widget called description, which is a multi-line label, that's it. And then we have a button, which took just close the window. And then we inline JavaScript there to say, no, close it. Like the box packing stuff is GTK-like, but the names are different. They're not all the same name. Some of the other delay trees work is just completely different. So I can't think of one single inspiration. They seem to have borrowed from several. We'll open the JavaScript file associated with that. So we said onload when the window loads, run that function. In the JavaScript file referred to it, we define that function. And I don't know if you've seen that this is the JavaScript object syntax. It doesn't have to be a JavaScript object. It's just cleaner namespaces things. So you define a JavaScript object which has one method called fill. And all it does is get the ID of the multi-line text field. We gave it an ID here, so we can refer to it here using document get element by ID, similar to how you do it in web pages. And then we just assign the value attribute to LCA rocks. Then the other bits, the part I mentioned about where you actually put the strings, that's really straightforward. We saw those three things there, and it just says, this entity, name this, is that. That's it. It's in the English directory. If someone wanted to localize your extension into, say, Spanish, they'd make another separate directory, use the same name, and put the strings in Spanish. And the other little bit would be the styling thing I mentioned, which all it does is say, make that class, whatever associates with that class, bold text. So we look in the header label, we give it that class. Again, very similar to web pages if you dealt with HTML and CSS before. So that basically defines this very simple window that displays some text and a close button. We want a way to be able to get at it from the UI, though. So another bit we include. This hooks it into the rest of the browser UI. This is called an overlay. This is if you want to insert menu items or toolbar items or whatever in the main browser UI. You define one of these and you hook it in. Again, it's pretty straightforward. And once again, define a DTD for localized strings. We define overlay and not a window this time. We have a little JavaScript associated with that, because here we're only defining a menu item. And the code to run when the menu item is selected is in that JavaScript file. And the menu item is just the menu item tag. There's a label with, again, a localized string, the on command I mentioned before, and that goes into the menu, the browser-defined menu, menu tools pop-up, putting it in the tools menu. And the associated JS file is very simple. On menu item command, we'll just open a new window with a path to the other ZIL file we made, and Chrome says it gives Chrome privileges, which means there's a notion of privileges within the browser, whereas web content, which is something privileged, and there's Chrome, which is privileges the entire browser has, like a local application, and we're saying we want full privileges. So to see that in action, I've already done this here. And tools, well, I'll go back and do it. So tools, we have something called LCA extension. And it's all fuzzy. It's the header that is bolded, as I mentioned before, the string set by the JavaScript, and the close button. Yeah.
How did you figure out what the name of the tools menu was in context of what the browser calls it?
Yeah. There are parts of that are not well documented. the general good approach is to look at the existing extensions out there. You can also crawl through the browser code and look at it there. But yeah, generally, for things like that, until the documentation a bit more fleshed out. Look at other examples. Lots of extensions put themselves in the tool menu, for example. But yeah, you just find stuff there. It's just, yeah, not well documented. All right. So, for those following along, I'll show you how to put that in. Usually when we're developing extensions, you want to use a separate profile. The easy way to do that you want to read that? Start Firefox with the Profile Manager command line option. So the reason you want to use a separate profile is because you'll be mucking about with, for instance, breaking your browser, and you don't want to disturb your normal browsing session. So I'll create a profile called LCA 2007. Tutorial. Are people actually following along with the tarball or no? I'll pace accordingly. Is anyone? All right. Get rid of that. And then it's just started a new browser instance from scratch. Along with that, with a separate profile, you want to set a couple of preferences in the browser. These are a few useful ones. The first one is JavaScript options show in console, which basically, usually Firefox hides messages from Chrome, from extensions, any error messages, any exceptions. You turn that, you've set that to true, and then it shows them to you. So you keep the error console open, and if you're wondering what the hell happened, you can look at it there, and there might be useful information there. Second is ng layout debug disable dual cache. So usually when you're running extensions, it loads an extension on startup, it caches it into a cache file, a post-process cache file. So if you change it on disk, it's not going to reflect. So this just simply disables this, so you can change your extension, change the tool, change your JavaScript without restarting the browser. And the third one is browser DOM window dump enabled, which simply makes the dump command actually dump to the console instead of chewing it up. The dump command, by default, the JavaScript command, it's like print or print or whatever in other languages. Dump will just, it takes a string, dumps it out to the console. On your usual release build, it doesn't go anywhere. When you turn this on, it goes to your console. So if you want to do printf debugging, it's very useful. So why don't we do that, actually?
In Firefox, just checking that now, two of those preferences don't seem to exist in the about config.
Yes.
How do you get to put them in there manually, or how does that work?
Let me get to that, but there's a couple ways. In about config, you can right-click and say new. That's one way. In the little bundle. There's that file, user.js. You can stick that into your profile. If you have one already, just append to it, and then that's a quick way of setting it. So I'll go ahead and actually do that, like I said. That's it. Just copy the file. And to start just coding your extension, I already have it here, and I should actually go through the files. What I went through there, so there's the Zool and the JavaScript live in the content directory. This is a very standard layout for an extension. Not all the files have gone through yet, but this is a simple add LCA rocks. This is the UI. This is the overlay. Then we have the locale directory, which has the two entity files and the skin. And the other thing to make an extension is you want to tell Firefox where your stuff is. So you say, oh, my content is in the content directory, and we give it a name, like an LCA sample. Then you tell it where the overlays are, and it's based off the name we gave LCA sample. It's an LCA sample, content, and then overlay. Google Chrome is a special protocol to say browser internal things. Then we say where our locales are, and then we say where our CSS files live. It's very simple. It's nearly boilerplate beyond the name. It used to be a lot worse. It used to be this horrible XML file, but since Firefox 1.5, it's a lot friendlier. So once we have chrome.manifest, we'll make a file called sample. Which, so I have one line to say, where to find the extension with that name. And now we hooked up to that directory. Why did you do that? Weird. It sometimes does that when you add those press. Not do something right. All right. Edge it along profile, duh. There we go. There it is. The same thing in our new Firefox profile.
Yes. To where your attention is, but you don't have to actually
install it. No. When you're developing, you don't want to go through all that stuff. So this is, you can live in your file system unpacked, and you can do development while the browser is running, even.
Is there a reason you had that, like, naming for that?
Sorry. Was there a reason that you had that naming for the folder name that points to where it really lives? It was something .com?
Yes. It's just a convention. I picked flock.com since I can, but it can be arbitrary. It just has to be relatively unique, as in it shouldn't conflict with anything else. It used to be just actually GUIDs, which is long and unwieldy, so now they made it friendlier where you get to shut names. So it just has to be something unique.
Okay, just a unique ID.
Yeah.
Is there a tool to use to create like a skeleton extension? So you don't have to remember the directory structure and all that every time?
Yes, there are several tools. There are actually a number of tools people have written to do this. You can find more on developermozilla.org. But yeah, there's tools to automate this. So that wasn't too hard. It didn't really do much either. To really do powerful things, there's a component framework in Mozilla called XPCOM. It provides hundreds of objects where you can do a number of things, and the entire platform is written in it. So, yeah, it's the way to do something in Mozilla. It actually supports multiple languages. First, JavaScript, of course, since it's used a lot. C++, that's the other thing the language of browser is written in. But there's also bindings for Java, Python, Perl, and Ruby. A caveat with those there is that they're not available on every platform, notably Windows, which doesn't come with Python, Perl, or Ruby. So you can't assume that's there, but if you have a controlled environment, if you prefer to write in those languages, you can. So I'll do a quick example. With that same example, we'll go back to our Zillow file. I've already written it, so I can't spell. Just change where the script refers to, and I'll show you. So this is a bit more involved. It's still very simple, but this is actually, instead of hard coding what the value for the description widget is, it reads it from my Etsy hostname file. So I'll start. So all the Mozilla, the XCOM objects, the classes, are given names like mozilla.org/something-something. So to create, say, a file object, we use components classes, mozilla.org file, local. That's the object or the class we're making. And then classes can have, or objects can have, object definitions, can have multiple interfaces attached to them. So this file local implements the NSI local file instance interface. So we say we want to create an instance of that interface using that class. So then we have this object here. And then we just init it with the path name, etc/host/name. And then we want to read from it. So we make an input stream, which is yet another object which has implemented another interface called NSI file input stream. And we initialize that with the file object, the name. It's file object is basically just a name or a way to manipulate path. And the magic numbers are basically boiled down to Unix open flags. We're opening it read-only. And since JavaScript cannot directly deal with an input stream, we hook it into a scriptable input stream. So we instantiated another object, the interface scriptable, NSI scriptable input stream, and then initialize that with the input stream, and then we just read it. So by that point, data holds the value of the contents of etc/host name. Clean ourselves up. Since it's a multi-line, it could be multi-line, it has a new line in it. We create a text node from out of the document, get the description, the description widget, and then append that text to the description widget. This all makes sense.
So how portable is this across different versions of Mozilla Firefox? And given that you said you're just using Unix arguments, would this work on Windows?
Yes, the Unix arguments do work on Windows. The file name, the path having slashes in it, won't. But yes, but it abstracts this all. So this is all portable. This works in all three platforms. This is file access, so it hasn't changed since Firefox 1.0. Although I'm for this talk, I'm mainly targeting 1.5. Like the whole thing with the way you register extensions, that is a 1.5 feature. 1.0 is end of line anyway. So. So we made that change in the Zool file to point to the different JS file, which now reads from etc/host name. We can just go to our browser and run it. And my host name for this machine is Guava. Didn't have to restart the browser. Just change the file to them, make sure they're saved, and it's all done. Yes, more or less. There is some new API in Firefox too, but that's about it. So now we want to package this up. So usually when you install extensions, you have this XPI file or zippy file, which you download for the web and then it prompts you to install it and all that. And right now it's all just living on our file system. So we want to make this. And it's really, really simple. But firstly, we have to make a little file to tell the browser which browsers we're compatible with. And that is install.rdf. And this is a bad old long XML file. It's an RDF, which is a resource description format. This is mainly boilerplate, so if you look at the part of GZ file I gave earlier on, we'll have it in it. There's tools to automate this as well. pilot certain things, we again want a unique ID, which is the same thing I use in the file name in the extension directory. Give it a friendly name. The version of the extension, 1.0, short description, who made it. There's some other stuff, but that's the basics. And then we want to say what application we support. So this extension supports two applications, both Firefox and Flock. They both are compatible. They have the tools menu, so it all will work. You have to make an entry for target application for each of these. The main thing being you need the GUID of the application, which is on many places on the web. And you want to say what version you're compatible with. We're compatible with Firefox 1.5 and 2.0 and bug fixes beyond that. So we've done the same thing for Flock, which has a different GUID. And Flock isn't 1.0 yet, so we support the earliest version that actually worked, and 1.0 for now. So it's mostly boilerplate. It's just so that you can say, like, because in Firefox 3, they will break some of these things. So it's as a safeguard so people don't install potentially broken extensions. You declare what you've tested with, you know that works. And once you have that, there is a little script which is on the developer Mozilla, and it's on kbmozilla.org, and also in the tarball, which I provided, which takes this tree, which we made for developing on, and will turn it into a zippy file for you. While developing the extensions, we just have them existing on your file system, so you can change it at will. But when you want to distribute it to other people, that gets packaged up into a little installer bundle. And this is how we're making it.
Is the tutorial for Tarball available for download right now?
Yes. I can put that. For those who arrived late, that's there.
Is auto-updating for extensions included as part of the extension, or is that part of add-ons at Mozilla?
In the installed RDF, you can provide a URL for where to update. In the absence of that, it uses add-ons at Mozilla.org. There is basically a format to where you can describe what updates for your extension. I might get to that later, depending on time, but yeah. AML provides a bunch for you, but you can override it if you want to host it on your website. So there's this boilerplate script again. There's the actual script called build.sh, and then there's another little shell script used to configure it. Well, you basically say the name of your extension. And this is a very simple extension. The rest of it is the default. You can say you can give additional directories if you have additional stuff in there. And you just run this. And we now have a zippy file made out of our extension. So I'll start another instance of Firefox. Why didn't it not work? Oh well. I'll just click on the zippy file there. Installed. And then there we have it. So what the script does, it just takes that directory tree, makes a jar file, which is effectively a zip file, out of the three directories we had for the ZOOL and the JavaScript content, the skin for the CSS, and the locale for the entities. It takes from manifest and actually changes it slightly to refer to the jar file, and then zips it all up, does this all for you. You don't have to worry about it. Now for debugging your extension, this is the simple ones. There's alert, which works like it is in the UI, and web content, which displays a dialog of a given string you do, and there's dump, which I mentioned before, which spits out to the console. And then we have some useful tools, like the DOM inspector, which if you're developing UIs, you can select the window and examine what's going on. So you're debugging a complex UI or seeing what's going on. You can also change values on it on the fly if you just want to see how things work. There's also something called Bankman, which is a JavaScript debugger. It's an interactive debugger, so if you want something more than alert and dump, that's something to use. It can make your browser slower, though. And then there's Extension Developer's Edition, which automates the setting of those preferences. It lets you create some of those, the boilerplate, like I said. All right. That's just a kind of basic overview. We can have a little break right now. We'll continue. So the next thing to do, sort of do things that are useful, is to actually talk to the network since we're a web browser and we can do that. For those of you who use XML HTTP request, you basically use that. It's very similar, although the way you create an object is slightly different. That's the simplest way to do it. You can interact with some of the lower level components. If you want to directly, you get more flexibility there. It is a bit more verbosity. So let's just add that to our extension. So the same structure as the previous two fill function definitions. One thing kind of tricky though is that since we're getting stuff from the web, this needs to be done asynchronously. So we're not going to get the same context of the environment. Right now we're in the ZOOL document context and all that, and we have certain things like document and window. Since JavaScript's a cool language, it does do closures, so we can just save off the document variable off into our own thing for later use, create the text node and to add it to the description widget. Then we instantiate an XML HTTP request object. Again, this object with this name implements this. And then the rest is pretty much like you do in web content. You say open, use the get method, get this file on my website, which doesn't have much in it. But it just says, that. We'll get that from the web and insert it into our UI. So we use the get method and we fill the onReady state change function. This is exactly like how you do it in web content. We wait for it to finish getting the document. It was a successful get, and then we use the response text out of that to fill our widget. There's also response XML like on in web content, so and then that is a full DOM object which you can manipulate into whatever you want with. And finally, we just send it. And then the function exits, which is why we need to save document off, and we can't use this throw. Should change that. I'll go back to our ZOL file. Change it to use a new file. And then it gets it from the web. That was a little delay, and it filled it on the fly. So that's basically how you interact with the network. You use XML as your request. You can go beyond that and you do some of the lower level, which I won't get into unless people ask me. Now, one thing to watch out for when you're getting stuff from the network is the thing that extensions run with full privileges as the whole browser, which means they can access local files, as you've seen, and do things like, you know, RMRF slash your disk and other things. So when you're pulling stuff from the network, you want to make sure you're not using like running code or that includes displaying HTML because they can have JavaScript within it in the Chrome context. So you don't want to run untrusted code as well down to. And if you really need to, like for JSON, you can use components util sandbox, which just says, here, I have this URL, I have this bit of code. I want to run this bit of code within that URL context. And it's pretty simple to do. That's more or less it. Use components util sandbox, pass the URL in for the context that you want to run in. Then eval the code you have in that sandbox. And then we get the result out of that and we just dump it out. And any errors we just ignore here, but you can do whatever you want. There's things like storing data on the user system. You can use files, you can write the files, not only read them as we've seen, but there's also the easy way, you can use preferences. There's also RDF, as we've seen, you use elsewhere, like installed RDF. There's a full set of tools to read and write those and manipulate them. And new in Firefox 2 is using SQLite, so you have a full SQL, local SQL database to access data with. Preferences are very, very simple to use, but they're not good for a large amount of data because they just get serialized to disk as text and just kind of really slow. But if it's like one-off little integers or strings here and there, that's fine. I'll show an example how to use that. We give a preference key, in this case, lca-sample.data. Now we get the preferences object, and then we just set a value to that preference I'm calling it, some data, and then the rest of the code simply gets the data. And if the preference doesn't exist, it'll throw an exception, so you want to catch that and provide a default value. There's also RDF, which is much more complex to use, but it gives you lots more stuff. It is effectively a hash table. There's key value pairs, and then, but you can hook some structure to it and basically generate an arbitrary graph out of it. Mozilla itself uses it internally. In Flock, we use it much more extensively, actually. We use it for the data store for bookmarks, as well as photos and people and all that. And the neat thing about RDF is that in Zool, you can say, here's a tree or here's a list, and here's an RDF store. Go display it, and it will figure out how to get it out of the RDF store and show it to the UI for you, and it's all very fast. So for displaying large amounts of information and dealing with that, which must be persistent, RDF is a good way to go. It can also composite different sources together. So if you have multiple RDF files, you can merge them all in one in the same fashion. So it's all pretty powerful. As an example, but Flock. RSS feed data, store everything about the item in it, except for the content. One caveat to RDF is that if you're having large and large amounts of text, it's slow. So actually in Flock for feed, which I work on, the feed reader, the metadata about each item is stored in RDF, but the items themselves are stored in SQLite, which I'll get to next. SQLite, some of you may have heard of it. It's just a small library that stores data in a file and lets you access it via SQL. It's new in Firefox 2. There's an API for it. It's very, very fast. It's also only in Firefox 2, so if you're targeting 1.5, you can't use it, although 1.5 is supposed to be end of line in April, so what's your excuse? And yes, it's a full SQL database access. And there's JavaScript bindings to it. One caveat still, there's, unlike RDF, there's no easy way to hook it up to a UI. That should change in the future, although when that future is unclear. I mean, tentatively Firefox 3, but they might get punted.
Just one quick question about the RDF. Is anything other than RDF XML supported as a format for reading that? Does it support N3 or Turtle or N-triples?
No.
No.
It doesn't have to save to a file, though. It can be in-memory RDF. Mm-hmm. But the way to serialize it is XML. More on Zool. The example I gave was just very, very simple, labels and buttons. As I said, the whole browser UI is made in Zool. So all the menus, the toolbars, the list and tree, like I said, which can be hooked up to RDF, and then Wizard, and you have all HTML editors, and then even a browser tag, so you can pick a browser in a browser, which gets kind of weird. But it's a full, rich GUI environment, and you can do many, many things. Also, a good thing is targeting multiple apps. So you could write an application that works in Firefox and Flock, or Firefox and Thunderbird, or any of that. But perhaps like some of the menus are different, or some functionality is different, or you want to enable, like when you're in Thunderbird, do something different because there's mail. You can use a way to query what app am I running under, and use the NSI Zool app info interface, and it provides, among other things, the app GUID. version number, and if you wanted to build ID, like if you wanted to tell the difference between nightly builds or whatever, because you're doing something in bleeding edge. Give a quick example of that as well. So here, we have the ID for Flock, the GUID, the ID for Firefox. Once again, get the, I didn't talk about this. There's a notion of, all the object creation so far have been creating instances. There's a notion of services, which are singletons, effectively. In this case, the app info is a singleton. So instead of creating an instance, you get service. You got to be careful because it doesn't actually enforce this. But, yeah, if something is, I mean, in this case it actually isn't, but most of the time services have service in their name, so you know you get service on them. So when you get the app info service and you just do a string comparison on the IDs, except that there's also version, so you can use check version numbers and build ID, which you get another string comparison. And then for convenience, I've listed some common GUIDs in this file. Firefox Flock, Thunderbird, you all know. NVU is a HTML editor, and Sunbird is a calendaring app. There are others, usually on the website of whatever app, they'll tell you what it is. And these are useful links. DevelopMozilla.org is the main site. It has a ton of info. Zool Planet is a handy reference to all the components and all the Zool tags and all that. And KBMozilla.org also has a bunch of reference info. So there's actually a lot of ground to cover, and that's where these sites will help. But 1.5 hour is not enough time to cover everything there is in Mozilla. It's a very large application. As for example, anyone got these? Okay. Planet, which I said is a very useful site. Yes, as you can see, there's a bunch. Kind of hard to read. No, there's a bunch. There's a bunch of, these are all Zool widgets. So you want to see what's going around, you click around there. There's lots and lots of documentation on how to use all these on the site. And there's literally hundreds and hundreds of objects to use. It can be kind of overwhelming. Just if you have to experiment around, and I also look at the examples of all the other, lots of other extensions on what to do. But hopefully this can get you started. I'm going to open for general questions now.
Are there any good examples of doing extensions in C++ that you'd recommend as a place to look to learn how to do it from that you can think of?
Python? The code base itself actually has, I mean, how to do stuff in C++. I didn't cover any of that. It is in some ways harder because it is C++ and not, but in some ways it's easier because there's a lot of boilerplate which the preprocessor hand waves away for you. So Yeah, but actually look at the app. They're in the extensions directory in Mozilla itself. There are a number of extensions there. Most of them, I think, are C++.
Those XPCOM interfaces look quite clunky in JavaScript. Is there any like wrappers or anything to make it a bit easier to use for JavaScript when you're doing extensions?
Not really. There have been plans that involve some arguments how to actually do it. One shortcut I use is show some code. What I tend to do here. Make a shortcut. So you can type in components.classes, you can just do cc and then bracket and then .ci. Like that. So that makes it less clunky, but still kind of annoying. There are some other, like, yeah, this is a recognized problem. It is kind of verbose. How to fix it probably won't get around to, like, Mozilla 2, I mean, beyond Firefox 3. It's, again, one of those things where in C++ it's kind of easier because it provides macros and all that for making this easier. But yeah, this just saves typing. It actually helps a lot.
Can you do any direct database connections, or do you have to do it all through an HTTP request?
You can direct. You can open to a port and talk to it if you wanted to. I don't know if anyone's actually done that, but it's certainly possible. You can, if you wanted to, write a binding to like a MySQL library,
yeah,
and then expose that to an XPCOM object and then do all that. Yeah, it's totally doable.
I was wondering if you could just give a quick plug for Flock and what it's about.
Okay. The idea behind Flock, the ideals of Firefox is that lean and mean browser, extended via extensions and all that. Flock is more like, because really only 5% of users actually use extensions. So, yeah. So we're trying to pick a good subset of integration with like some of the web properties out there, like Flickr, PhotoBucket, MySpace, Facebook, as well as integrated blog editor and integrated feed reader and all. So it's just kind of a richer. It does more. It's not for everyone, but for we're targeting users who want something that's easy to use and it's well integrated. So yeah, again, mostly non-geeks. But the cool thing is that yes, you can build on top of Firefox. It's open source. Block is open source as well. In fact, I just showed you code from it. So yeah.
I was just wondering if there was any support for integrating with external Java applications, such as possibly RMI support.
There is a Java XPCOM binding. I don't know a whole lot about Java. Other than that, yes, you can write. Actually, you can write components in Java. You can write an extension in Java if you wanted to. Does that answer your question, or?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know if it actually uses RMI or not.
If I can write an extension in Java, I can.
You can
use RMI from.
Right. You can RMI from the extension. Yes.
I was just wondering, like, given that like the extensions have like a pretty free for all, and like with things like Java applets, you need to sign them to give that permission. Is there anything like, I know you don't need to sign extensions to give them permission, but is there any way to say that it really, you know, sign it because it really did come from me?
From
Flock or whoever?
Yeah, there is some policy. So if you ever notice when you install an extension, if you're not installing it from like a few trusted places like addonmozilla.org or whatever, it prompts you and say, I blocked this if you want to whitelist this. So it's assuming that, okay, you're installing from addonmozilla.org, it's been, you can't just get on there. That you went through some form of, you know, this doesn't do anything malicious or anything like that. There isn't really a concept of signing it other than that. It's more where it came from, where it was linked from, actually. It doesn't matter where it came from, where it was linked from.
Okay, cool.
Hi, I'm just wondering, like, I mean, I've had quite a few stability problems with, you know, like, heavily overloaded or extension installed versions of Firefox, and I'm thinking, is there any work that's going on to sort of isolate the extensions from one another, or in Windows perhaps could run in separate processes, or?
Not near term.
Okay.
This is, again, Mozilla 2 or post-Firefox 3 sort of. Post-Firefox 3 is a lot of, yes, it's going to break things, like, you know, break API and all that, like, and remove some baggage and hopefully fix some of the problems. That is like 2008, 2009 kind of time frame. So not near term, no.
And I understand that Adobe donated a JavaScript interpreter recently?
Yes. The VM for interpreting bytecodes in Flash, Adobe donated the VM for that to Mozilla, and that's, again, something post-Firefox 3, but that is actually being actually worked on and should happen for them. But, yeah, it does, like, JIT and all that. So it should make JavaScript run faster, which will make the web run faster, as well as the browser run faster.
Are there any good books you can recommend for learning more about Mozilla and XP-com?
Yeah, I forget the title of it. There was one good book. I don't remember. There's actually online too. Yeah, there's lots of not so good books.
Can you remember the publisher?
No, I will post the link to it when, you know, to the attendees mailing list. I did totally blanking on it, but yeah, it is actually an online book. Like, you can buy the book in print, but it's all online for free. And that was the nice thing about that. I don't remember the name of it. I will send it out, though.
Okay, thanks.
As you mentioned, there's a lot of components that are accessible, a hell of a lot,
mm-hmm.
and there's a crap all documentation. So how did you go about, like, learning them? What we can do and how to use them?
Looking at other code. That's basically it. Actually, yeah, there. If you haven't looked, there's the LXR for Mozilla, which is, yeah, you can't live without that when you're actually developing for Mozilla. And then there's, like, Mozilla Planet, which is you can search for, like, I don't know, how to open a file or, you know, something like that. So there's a search engine, so you can sort of get an idea for it. But it's, yeah, it's looking at example code, seeing what others are doing. I mean, is there, like, something you're curious about that you can do or not, or? Okay. It is daunting. One thing also, really, in JavaScript, as the Mozilla people are moving more and more towards writing the code in JavaScript and less C++. So there's more and more example code by people who know what they're doing. So that helps. All right, I guess that's it.